And the value proposition for equity, because that's the question I just recognized that we were supposed to answer when I came in and saw the title on this, is that equity, with equity, everyone wins as long as it's done in a fair and just manner. The role and potential of communities is a workshop that the Roundtable on Population Health Improvement held in Los Angeles to be closer to the communities involved. Many of the workshops are held in Washington, D.C., where your surroundings are completely with policy wonks, academicians, and government folks. But if you're going to be serious about talking about equity, then you do nothing about them without them. And that should be an adage or an admonition that you all take to heart. We talk about the role and potential of communities in three contexts, about organizing or community participation or youth organizing, which might have more to do with the interests of youth, but school justice and other issues, or partnerships with institutional actors such as academic researchers that we had an example of earlier, public health agencies and others. Manuel Pastor from USC had been one of the presenters in that workshop and told us about three different paths to community engagement. The Potemkin way, which is just for show. The Kabuki way is a stage conflict and dueling experts, and maybe authentic community engagement, which is really the real deal and which is our currency for the California Endowment. From engagement to policy, building community ecosystems is important. Multiple stakeholders for capacity and policy impact. We have to take into account all of the milieu that people live in. It's really the entire surroundings and their entire experience. And in fact, in the populations that have the greatest adversity in society, it's also their cultural background, what they bring with them, and their history, such as history of being subjected to racism or oppression or discrimination, whether it's in this generation or in prior generations, still shows up in current conditions. And the role of communities in the development and review of environmental justice, for example. And we have challenges and opportunities that we deal with, inside and outside tensions between decision makers, communities needing to be part of that power structure, yet have been kept out because of low education, because of cycles of, again, oppression or elimination from the power table and the structures that make the decisions about where that community can find opportunity. And then policy change, again, a power proposition. Building community power requires organizing and community organizing to mobilize, because there's no one individual in the community that has the power of a Donald Trump, for example, and you can imagine why. So we need to organize and have plurality in numbers, and numbers in voices, voices that turn into votes, and votes that turn into elected officials that do the will of the people, not the will of the power structure. At least not the business power structure, whose own interest is in mind and has maybe contributed to that oppression and contributed to the conditions that exist that create that oppression for financial gain of a few individuals. That's the 1% versus the 99%. So in Los Angeles, we saw a community coalition that has community action planning and implementing for change at its heart, and has seen tremendous change occur, not the least of which their executive director became elected as a state official and is now at the state level as a legislator, being able to actually exert the community power and the community perspective from her particular perch, which is tremendous, and another one represented to the U.S. House of Representatives. So that's the power that we need to see from communities to create change, to create equity. It's the best kind, it's the most visible kind, and it's the one that we would all aim for, because really isn't that what we mean about equity? Is all of these communities currently suffering from inequity, being able to raise themselves and be raised up to levels of where they can have full participation in society and are able to enjoy the same benefits of prosperity that the rest of the society enjoys. So organizing to close liquor stores is a fundamental street-level activity that was important to that community, and targeting a crime-ridden park with a variety of classes and community activities and community organizing around issues, door-to-door, holding community meetings, getting people to engage that hadn't engaged before. Partnership with academia, complex history, but there are positive models. The USC programs and the Kansas programs and true relationships with co-learners, extremely important. But the leave-behinds are probably what's not recognized as being as important as community thinks they are. Because what we mean by community health and by equity isn't a full employment act for people that have gone through graduate school and public health, but rather full employment for the community themselves, and how much transference of that kind of knowledge that a researcher or a project or an NIH-funded research project brings to the community, and what it leaves behind in terms of community capacity, should be the true measure of the value of that research, not what gets published in a journal, but what have you left behind so that community is better off. So this thing about engaged research needs to be thought of in a different level if we look at it through an equity lens. So this community partnership can result in things about loan applications for homes or expanding healthy food sources in parks, power of different consortia, spheres of leadership influence and facilitated dialogue. All of these are partnerships that bring ideas to communities or build on community ideas to begin with, which is really the more genuine way of grassroots to treetops pushing agendas. And that's the one that is the most deeply embedded that we've found in our work over time. So things like youth voices or community resident, authentic community resident voices that rise up and sustain over time are the ones that the community themselves initiated. And that takes time, and it's a lot of dirty work, and it means that it's inconvenient for folks that live somewhere else that have to come in and work with the community on hours that are more convenient to people that have 2 and 3 jobs and 5 kids and 7 kids to take care of. They can only meet on Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning after church. But it means that if you can work with them at that level and be at the meetings and month after month and year after year in the same conditions that they are living under, that's when you can gain the trust and see the change happen and get people to truly embed their ideas with you and you with them and understand where they're coming from. Jóvenes Sanos in Watsonville, which Mary Lou works closely with, is one of the examples and models that came forward, and a youth leader from that group telling very articulately and passionately about what they've done to change their community and social conditions and how they work in coalitions and work with each other to move community agendas, and that has become a trajectory for that individual and others to then go on to graduate school, into health professions, into social service professions. And is one of the tremendous co-benefits of working on equity is that you can have then generational trajectory, breaking that cycle of failure by the individuals themselves that have benefited from that community empowerment to take that on and to make it their life's work for the rest of their life, and also to become a community role model, a solid parent, somebody who works for change for the rest of their lifetime. And that is lasting and sustainable change that is truly meaningful. Forming task forces with other like-minded people and working with policymakers and learning how to tell those effective stories from a community perspective. Power, power, power. And that's what it's really all about, changing the narrative about what creates health and what creates equity from the point of view of a person who lives in that kind of environment themselves. Kids Rethink New Orleans is another example, again, post-Katrina and the plight that they were facing, and then how long it's taken to recover from that. And Inner City Struggle in Boyle Heights. And this is a youth group that is working solidly behind school justice and justice reform that has kicked so many kids out of school because of what's considered to be confrontational behavior or some minor offenses in school, and kids are sent home. And what happens there is they hang out on street corners and become part of gangs, become part of who else has been kicked out of schools, who else is just hanging around by the daytime. And so it's just a cycle of a downward spiral. And instead of being a school to prisons pipeline, breaking that by making sure the kids stay in school and get justice that's meted out by their peers in a reformed system, and has resulted in a lot fewer kids being pushed out of school and out of their education. Our Building Healthy Communities model is based on a place-based approach, a 10-year investment in these 14 places in California, and our theory of change is built around capacity building at its roots. That's the people power part I was telling you about. And then moving on to policy system change and environmental change. And over time, seeing that materialize as health status change. We have a collaborative, a little bit of a complex model here, but our basic functions, our basic drivers are youth empowerment, changing the narrative so that people understand differently about health, collaboration around policy approaches and policy change, leveraging resources for sustainability, community building, and learning and evaluation. And through our structure, which requires a local hub, local collaborative that works with the community organizations in that area, we're able to get folks working in the directions of all of these different kinds of, or different flavors of what health means. So in schools, it's about the school climate, the wellness, comprehensive support. It could be neighborhoods around food environments and economic development and health and justice. Restore and heal, like the Prop 49 that Mary Lou referred to, and healthy youth opportunities. And at the prevention level, we even talk about moving the healthcare delivery system to a more prevention-oriented system, looking upstream, looking at all of the factors, and moving into community prevention and partnerships with public health and with other sectors in a health in all policies approach. So some of the highlights that make the newspaper or make YouTube or make social media are a lot of youth, again, using data models, using communication models as examples, seeing students and teachers addressing truancy or moving that on so that even the governor receives a bill after so many communities have done the same sort of approach, getting students active about the injustice of being pushed out of school. The state has responded by creating a bill that has resulted in an enormous drop then of things like truancy, kids being pushed out of school, and now expected to be higher rates of high school graduation. That's a bottom line kind of issue and an impact that we can't deny will have longer term ramifications, positive. So people power for equity, storytelling and narrative so that we build trust within organizations and relationships that bridge values and interests, making data more meaningful. Community organizing to focus our action and strategic partnerships for momentum and policy change for scale and sustainability. All of those critical factors, you can mark those off as a checklist. Have we really worked in those arenas? Can we make sure that we did pay attention to them? Because those are the critical factors when you think about working with community and the impacts that you might feel. Other key themes might be health is not an end in itself, but the means to other ends. Productivity is probably a bottom line issue. Justice and equality, lifestyle, and what you can contribute broader to society. Power, knowledge, and expertise in communities, that community members can bring these assets to the table as equal partners, and youth not just as targets for change, but becoming agents of change and inspired future decision makers. I gave you an example of that, but investing in youth and having expectations of ways that the payback is like paying forward will be much greater than what they can do with that present program. So not simply as users, but as agents themselves. Health and justice for all is something that we're taking up. We hope you'll join us. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you so much, Ben. All right, I'm going to open the floor for a discussion. Question.
Subjects in a study. I said to my dad, they're your customers. The 10-year-old
they had a life and priority that wasn't our priority, and it took a huge, effort to teach the staff to treat the customers. They had to sell the idea of the research need for the people that had to be in charge. And we have, it works so well. So what you're saying, I just wanted to remark on how you're right on the mark, because what it took was treating them with, and it was just one word I decided 10 years later, it's the word respect. These kids, from the very warm homes, we need to treat them with respect. And so we've done 5 studies with them for NIH. We've just started our 6th NIH study this month. The young girls were born in 1977, are now 3 years old, and we have over 80% who are still. I mean, we can find them, it's really hard to find them, but if we can find them, they do it. They really understand what they're doing for science, for their race, for our understanding of their health, and they understand that we respect. So it's just been, you're just so on the target of how we treated subjects before. They are subjects. They are customers.
Thank you so much for that. I can actually reflect our roundtable for the promotion of health equity last year had a Native Voices, Youth Voices workshop, and we were in Albuquerque, and it was pretty powerful because when my role on that in that workshop was to convene the youth and to have a large panel and really get as many Native youth sitting at the panel and telling IOM workshop, what their thoughts were in terms of health equity and how where to move forward from their community and from their lens. And it was pretty powerful because, you go back to it respect, and they had a lot to say. And it was very clear that they wanted to be involved, and they had their vision on a future and a bright future for them and their community. And they really just were thirsting for somebody to, partner with them and move things forward and just to give them the chance and the platform, and they'll run with it. So amazing energy, really. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to actually follow what you just brought up with an example that I know came from the Kellogg Foundation, but I used to work at the Kellogg Foundation, and Dr. Wright was also the Kellogg Foundation. This was not in our area of our program, but I don't know if you know about the Healthy Food Line item incentive on the farm bill. That recommendation actually came from, I think it was a barber in Baltimore, someone who owned a corner store in Baltimore. When people were trying to figure out how to get people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, he said just do a twofer, because you see potato chips, 2-for-1. Why not do the same thing for fresh fruits and vegetables? That's what we talk about of innovation. And the strategy actually came from him and how could he best implement it at the local level. This is now on the farm bill. It's a line item on the farm bill, incentivizing the fresh fruits and vegetables.
You do. You just have to listen. Even in medical school, that's what I was told. Listen to the patient. Listen. Right? We forget that. Other questions, comments? Yes, please.
Around hepatitis B, and a lot of them will just tell me that they're not interested. their immigration status is. So they are the disenfranchised part of the population. And so I have a really difficult time actually engaging my patients and wanting to actually do more research and being part of this community and having ownership and partnership in it. And so when I come here, I feel great and I have all this energy. And you know, yesterday during the opening session, it brings a lot of energy into me. And when I go back, you know, then it's a bit of a distance. And I'm wondering from the panelists here, are there any recommendations for populations that don't speak English? And are there any tools that I can use? Because the Chinese community tends to be more, in a way, collective. And so speaking out is actually not something that's part of that community. And so how do I get people to want to come forward and do the work so that we can actually find out more about that community so that we can actually serve as that community? So I'm probably talking to that kind of challenge.
Thank you. I'll let George first, and then I can take it too.
I think sometimes approaching this rather than as individuals and doing individual interviews, especially when somebody has disclosure issues, focus groups are more effective. People feel comfort in others that they trust and know, and especially if they're in the same neighborhood and have been around them for some time, and they can feel comfortable with the group, either or a bit with a group of relatives. The same thing, especially in other communities that have integrated, feeling a little bit more security that way. And then they can participate and build on each other's experience. And your research needs to be designed around using focus group information, anecdotes, stories, then more so than individual answers that you might get collect from an individual. And then always humility, trust, respect, and sometimes it just takes time. Over time, they know you, they see you, they start to trust you, and they'll share more with you.
Jillian, thank you.
Thanks for saying that, elevating that issue. I have a question. Who designs your studies, and when do you engage people to participate? One point I'd like to make is that I think it's also important to ask people how they would like to be engaged, to participate in any type of research, even a clinical trial. And so you take care of that up front. You know, so recruitment won't be an issue. I know Dr. Bigby, I saw that she laughed. But this actually brought back memories of some of the work with racial and ethnic approaches to community health that was done in Boston around breast and cervical cancer. And a lot of, I mean, underground, upfront work was done basically asking people what would facilitate their participation or whether or not they would participate in the type of research that was being considered.
Terry, did you want to respond?
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Yes. We heard some similar sentiments when we were working with Native community and American Indian and Alaska Native both. And one of the approaches that was quite promising was going through the spiritual leader, whoever the spiritual leader for that community might be, or what the dominant religion is, or wherever they go for worship, and engaging the spiritual leader first to sanction it and to basically elevate it as an important priority for that community, and then doing it in the collective, because that population as well will not stand the hill. It's no such thing as an individual, it's the collective. And so it had to be a conversation, as the gentleman was suggesting, that includes members of that community in a collective voice. And but we learned that through the spiritual leader. That's where we learned that, was going to the spiritual leader. So that might work, I don't know, but it's an idea worth considering.
And so piggybacking on that and everyone else, so I work right down the street in Chinatown. So I've done a lot of work in many different studies across different areas, mental illness, wellness, depression, cancer, so things that are very stigmatized in Chinese, the Chinese community, and the language as well. So one thing that I can definitely say is if you are kind of your hands, you described it as hands are tied because it's either a pharma study or there's protocols. But what you can do, and I know Charles Bewong has a wonderful standing in the community, so if you can leverage the partnerships that have been created for other studies, like community research advisory boards or things that are already created for other studies in other departments, if there's a way you can kind of go talk to them and see, like present your study and then problem solve together how we could together improve recruitment for this study, but improve trust for being recruited into the study as well. I think that's really important across the board. We also have created our community-wide research advisory committee, so it spans across all studies. So it's kind of, it's not creating one siloed community research advisory board or CAB for one study and then another one for another study. And understanding that we're partnering with a community and that there's time, you know, constraints on everybody, not just academic researchers, but really a board that can really speak to across organizations, across sectors in the community, across people, together collectively about all research projects. And that kind of helps then, you know, for those that are, for projects that are more prescribed versus those that start from blank slate, bottom up completely. So hopefully those things help. Good luck. Questions? Oh, how about straight in the back first? Thank you. How about you next, and then we'll work this way.
One of the things we're talking with the giving run, the person is distraught. They're not quite sure what's really going on. So they're not used to research and things like that. Number two is stigma of whatever you have to present. It's something to do with disease and things like that. And they come from traditional society. They don't talk about illness and disease. And they don't want other people knowing about it. Diseases and things like that, even the people they know. And on the other hand, when we do research, and truly speaking, if you do research, that just have to pick people up and complete survey, that's fine. But if you want to do research in the community, the problem we have as researchers, we have our questions and everything and funding, and we go into those communities and we expect in 3 months, we gather our information and out we go. network.
Right.
If you don't have relationship already with those people,
right,
it's the same stuff they've always had with African American communities, immigrant communities, because they see you are just coming in and coming out, and then it just builds up again and again. We have to build relationships with people. If you have an existing relationship, when you go to them, you'll be surprised the amount of stuff you can get from them.
Absolutely.
They're very compliant, but if you just go in and out, and that's the major problem we have. We're always coming in and going out, and we expect them to, we expect to recruit them, and if they don't respond, we say, what's going on with them? And most of them have issues, same barriers regarding work. They do two jobs. Some of them can't do it on Monday, or Saturday, they can't really do it on Sunday. Some of them can't do it. Those kinds of things, we don't really take account of that when we put our impact together, and then we feel that, and they really don't respond, because we don't know why. So that's
thank you for that. Okay. Working back, I think somebody on the side, in the back, yeah. This is as far as it goes.
So this is a bit of a pulpit thing for me, if you've heard me in prior meetings about this. The source of all research money, not the source of most research money here in this country, is the National Institutes of Health. If you look at how much they're funding community research, it's a micro fraction of the total amount of research money. We're regarded as molecules, collections of molecules, and molecular level research ranks supreme in terms of what is paid attention to. As exemplified in the questions in this room, we need much more community level research funded so that we can better understand what kinds of models work. We need research that funds community approaches for a much longer period of time, so there is allowance for building the trust and the relationships and the time that that takes in order for us to gain community participation. And we need to follow the conditions over time, because it takes many years for elaboration of outcomes to occur after you do social, environmental interventions for change. So your questions, I'm sorry, it's not a simple answer. Where is the money? Foundations like mine work with health departments, and we do give funding, but it's not for research. Sake to answer those kinds of questions. It really is to invest in programs at the community level where there will be a more meaningful leave behind than simply knowledge to the scientific community. And I say simply because the leave behind at a more significant level is what kind of change can that create at the community. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the legacy to NIH, instead of all the mega buildings that we see at UCSF, UC San Diego, Harvard, all over the country, in these universities and pharmaceutical companies that can owe their profit-making or their legacy in buildings to NIH funding, and the billions of dollars in faculty and staff salaries that are based on NIH funding in those already highly moneyed institutions, and transfer that wealth to the communities that we're talking about, and we can end our conversation because equity will occur.